content of the following program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, treatment, or cure. Always consult your physician or a health professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Baby, do you want to go higher, baby? You're listening to One Life Radio. This is Bernadette with Diamond Gray. I've got Aviana Berrientos in studio with me. Marie Early's here and Dr. Mike McFarland, PhD. Always love having this guy in studio.
Love to
he's
be
like
here.
He's like a month. We get him like once a month. He's like just like a, he's a, he's a nice little treat.
I just drop in periodically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love it. You know, I actually have, I did a crazy thing yesterday, you guys. Well, we'll find out if you think it's crazy or not. And I'm embarrassed and proud to share it, actually, at the same time, because something took over my body at Shake Shack yesterday.
Okay.
My emotions got away from me. Well, I mean, I don't know. Let me tell you the story. So, but, you know, it's so good to discuss this with you because you're a shrink. You know, you're a PhD. So, you know, and Dr. McFarland, you can find him at McFarlandPsychology.com. He's a really great shrink who specializes in a lot of different things like anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive spectrum disorders, and male body image and eating disorders. And we also have Robert Whitaker on the show today, Psychiatry Under the Influence. He's written The Anatomy of an Epidemic. Really, really intelligent guys here today. You're not going to want to miss this show. So here's what happened at Shake Shack. So, you know, I had Mother's Day, and I actually had a really pleasant weekend doing a lot of nothing, just relaxing, which I very rarely get to do. And anyway, so I was at Shake Shack. That's where we decided to go to get something to eat for Mother's Day after my daughter had already, my youngest one now is working in her dad's restaurant. So after she got done pulling a shift, we went out and, you know, I visited my friend Michelle's mom at the nursing home and visited her. So then we went to Shake Shack, okay? And I'm sitting there peacefully eating my veggie burger and my cheese fries, and they were amazing, just by the way. And they're not paying for this. It's just one of my favorite places to go. When I'm going to have a cheat, that's where I go because their ingredients are higher quality than like a typical fast food restaurant. And so anyway, so I'm sitting there and I'm eating my burger. And first it wasn't busy. Then people started to trickle in, of course. So it's Mother's Day. So there's a lot of families that are out. And it's always funny. I don't know if you guys notice this on Mother's Day, how fathers take care of the kids on Mother's Day.
Yep.
And they're always drinking beer because that's the only way they can get. And it's so weird because you can tell like the mothers are just sitting around like, yeah, I gotcha today. Yeah, now you have to watch the kids while I drink a glass of wine, you know. You can see like a shift. You really can. It's kind of funny. But so I'm sitting there and there were birds flying around. And you know how obsessed I am with all animals, especially birds. And I have so many beautiful birds on my property. And I had just bought a bird painting over the weekend I can't think of the name of that store. It's something in Lily. Anyway, I bought this beautiful, one-of-a-kind painting that an artist, I can't think of his name. Anyway, I got all these.
But
all
it's
these,
beautiful.
But it's beautiful. I'll get the name of the artist and share it with the listeners. But so anyway, I'm taking too long to tell the story, but it's a really good story.
Good
You're
build
gonna
up.
Like it. It is a good build
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I'm like waiting.
I know. So I'm sitting there eating my burger and these kids start chasing the birds around, okay? At first, they were just kind of, not being real aggressive. But then this one boy came up from somewhere, and he was really violently running after the bird with a stick. I didn't say anything, but I gave him a real dirty, shameful look, like, you better stop. You know, he knew that from the look on my face that I didn't appreciate or like what he was doing. And it was very disruptive, too. Everybody was sitting there peacefully. If you've ever been to Shake Shack downtown at the Crescent, it's got a beautiful court out there when you sit, and there's like a ping pong table out there.
I love that area, yeah.
I love that area. It's very peaceful, and it's really nice.
The weather was beautiful.
The weather was to die for, to sit outside, and today, too, especially after all the rain we've had. So I'm sitting there, and then this little girl starts. And she violently went running after another bird, a little pigeon that, of course, we were feeding little pieces of bread because We love animals. We love birds. I mean, I don't understand the mentality of a child that would just violently run after a bird and try to hit it or swat it with anything, but with this ping pong paddle, you know? And so my eyes got real big, and I, on a scale of like 1 to 10, I asked my daughter, how loud was I? She said, about a 5, Mom. So I kept it, you know.
In the middle?
In the middle. Mm-hmm. And so, but I said, what are you doing? Why do you think that's okay? Why do you think it's okay to be violent to a bird? Why do you think that's okay? And everybody just stood up, kind of, you know, and not stood, a couple of them did, just kind of stood up and turned around and looked at me. And the little girl and her mother were just like, super embarrassed, which I probably would be too, but I would never allow my child to do that. I would never allow my child to violently chase a bird with a stick or anything. I just think it's so messed up. Okay, so let me ask you this, as a shrink, is that abnormal behavior for a child? And should you shut it down immediately? So you don't, you know, you don't have little
before I comment, I see Avia.
Yeah. I only have one question. What? How old was the kid? Do you know? Like, how old did he look?
Oh, they were both about 10 years old.
Okay.
They were both about 10 years old. What? Certainly old enough to understand that that's not okay.
Gotcha.
Sure. Yeah. So were they running with a stick, but sort of to get the birds to fly? Or
no.
Did it look like they were trying to hit them?
No, it was, they were trying, both of them. One boy, one girl, okay. Both around the same age, both very violent, just abusive behavior. And I said something. I stood up and said, I didn't stand up, actually. I sat down, but I was still sitting. And I just said, this is not okay. Why do people think this is okay? And everybody looked at me like, oh, my God, she's a weirdo. But I just couldn't hold it in because it's so wrong.
Sure.
And that's the kind of behavior, in my opinion, that leads to so many other disruptive things in our life. When you think that's okay, what the hell else do you think is okay? Mm-hmm. Right? Or am I just being emotional about animals?
Well, I think that you're pointing out something important, which is that people can sometimes dehumanize animals, which, of course, they're not human, so that's part of it, but see them as inferior. And there's
very
a big
predatory.
Difference between, there's a big difference between just chasing animals or kind of playing around with them and being physically threatening to them. And it sounds like from what you're describing, first a boy was doing it and then a little girl started doing
it.
But
I don't think they saw each other doing it. I don't know. Because it was about a 10-minute lapse in between.
Okay.
You know, but I just thought, why is this so prevalent? Mm-hmm. This is two separate children from two clearly separate families around the same age. And the parents aren't doing anything. They're just sitting there like, oh, eating their burger and thinking that that's okay. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. And I think it needs to be stopped.
Well,
so all the parents out there
things,
listening, you know, get a hold of yourself and your kids.
Yeah, we learn what's okay and what's not okay in our families of origin. So these kids are probably getting a message that that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think what you did, which was standing up for what you believe, but not necessarily in a really overwhelming way that disrupted the entire
No, I said
lunch,
it very calm.
You spoke your mind.
I spoke it like a mobster.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I was Vito Corleone of the bird sanctuary.
Uh-huh. Although he was kind of quiet.
Well, yeah, I was kind of, well, I was only on a level of 5.
Okay.
And I tend to talk loud and I'm Italian. So, but it made me so upset.
Well, and that becomes a learning opportunity for those children. Because probably they're not going to forget that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't think they're going to forget it anytime soon. I don't think anyone there will forget it. And it's not that I was that loud or that ugly. Mm-hmm. I just think they were so shocked that somebody actually spoke up against something wrong instead of you hear all the time, like somebody's getting raped in front of you and you just start whistling
people turn
and
a blind
walk away.
Eye. Mm-hmm.
Like, what the hell is up with that?
It's called diffusion of responsibility, and you took responsibility, you made a statement, and you stood up for those birds, which is, I think, awesome. And those kids, again, are going to take away an important lesson from that.
Mm-hmm. One mother gave me a thumbs up behind her back.
Terrific.
Went like this and gave me a thumbs back, because, I mean, when you're talking, people get real emotional when I took a chance, you know. Sometimes people can get extremely ugly when you call out their kids if they're misbehaving.
Right.
And like, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
You know, I was just waiting for that. I was like, well, here's who I think I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I was ready for it. Mm-hmm. I was totally ready for it. So, but I'm good on
my feet. So it sounds like you were proud of yourself for what you did, but then also kind of not sure if you were on the right track.
I'm glad I did it. No regrets.
Yeah, sounds like a wise move.
But, you know, I mean, everybody was staring at me. So
take some courage. It takes real courage.
It does take some courage to do that.
In a public setting.
But, I mean, what do you think, Diamond? Would you have done that? What do you, if you saw children being abusive to an animal in public, do you think that you would say something?
It just depends on, I had like a million questions for you. Like, I didn't know if the birds were getting around the food. No, I would never hit hit an animal, and I don't, you know, endorse kids like violently swatting animals. But I always try to look at the context of the situation.
Well, the whole garden area has got a ton of trees. Of course, you're going to have birds, and that's part of what they love is the birds. Mm-hmm. It's part of nature. Why do we get to think that? Oh, because we want to eat here. You know, we get to get rid of all, everything, strip everything in nature. We just want to enjoy the trees to ourselves. Birds are a part of nature. If you're going to sit in a garden, you're going to have birds, mm-hmm. and you need to respect them. And that starts at a very early age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just saying, everybody, the way people's lens are when they look at things, everybody has different perceptions of mm-hmm. their reality, and mm-hmm. it probably didn't mesh with yours with protecting the birds.
Well, it was very violent. I mean, it was just very violent. The children were violent. And I'm thinking, where do they, that's a good question. So where do they get to see that violence at such a young, tender age? Where did they learn that from? And furthermore, how did they learn that it was okay to mm-hmm. act that way?
Mm-hmm. You know, well, we learn things from, it's almost like osmosis from everything mm-hmm. that we see. And there's, you know, this idea that just from watching someone do something, we pick up something mm-hmm. from watching them. Even if we never try to do it, we now know how to do something.
Yeah.
So from the number of murders we've seen on TV, everybody here knows how to end someone else's life.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I don't like watching violence on television either.
Yeah,
it's terrible. It's too much violence in the world. But we've got a great show coming up. We do. We're going to be talking with one of my favorite people, Robert Whitaker. He is an American journalist and author who has won numerous awards as a journalist covering medicine and science. Love this guy. He's going to be talking about psychiatry under the influence. It's one of his many books, Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. And of course, Dr. Mike McFarland, PhD. We're going to be talking about identifying and treating binge eating disorders. Everyone, you're not going to want to miss it. Stay tuned. You're listening to One Life Radio. It is a giving of peace in your mind to a stranger, to a friend, to give in such a way that has no end. One Life Radio is brought to you by our sponsors, great companies like Sun Warrior Plant-Based Protein. Use the code OLR for 20% off. Crazy Water, the only mineral water bottled in Texas. KetoMed, ketogenic metabolic nutrition. Use the code OLR for $40 off and free shipping. Honest Hemp, happy, healthy, honest CBD. Use the code OLR for 20% off. Nature's Plate, plant-based meals to go. Paleo Magazine, Wellbeing Journal, and the International Society of Sports Nutrition. Be sure to go to our Thorne Research Dispensary on our website for 20% off and free shipping. Thank you for listening to One Life Radio. This song. What is it? Can't remember, Diamond.
Don't Answer Me, Alan Parsons Project.
Oh, yeah. I love
it.
Do you remember the Alan Parsons Project?
I do, vaguely, yes.
I just ran across, I don't know, one of their songs somewhere. Someone sent it to me, and I started to re-enjoy their music again. You know, you forget about certain bands from certain eras, mm-hmm. but they were one of the great ones. Everyone, welcome back to One Life Radio. This is Bernadette with Diamond Gray. I've got Aviana Barrientos in studio with me, Marie Early, Dr. Mike McFarland, and a very special guest on the line as well, Robert Whitaker. He is an American journalist and author who has won numerous awards as a journalist covering medicine and science. In 1998, he co-wrote a series on psychiatric research for the Boston Globe that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for public service. His first book, Mad in America, was named by Discover Magazine as one of the best science books of 2002. Anatomy of an Epidemic won the 2010 Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for the best in investigative journalism. He is the publisher of Mad in America. A Freudian slip there. Mad in America. And today we're talking about psychiatry under the influence. Such a pleasure to have you back, Robert. Thank you for jumping on the air with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, I've got two of your books here in front of me, Anatomy of an Epidemic and Psychiatry Under the Influence. So well written, so informative, all the awards that you've gotten. This is so great to be able to talk about some of this because I don't think there's enough awareness about pharmaceutical drugs, especially in the field of psychiatry. And I'm sure sure Dr. McFarland would agree. But today we're talking about your book, Psychiatry Under the Influence, Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. So tell me what inspired you to write this particular book.
Yeah, this book I actually co-wrote with Lisa Cosgrove, and it came out of work at a lab at the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University, which was set up to study institutional corruption in our society. And the idea was you have various institutions, Congress, even big eight accounting firms, and whatever the institution may be, that are supposed to serve the public, but they come under the spell of what we call economies of influence. Just think about financial influences, self-interest, that lead them to betray that public duty.
Mm.
So we were brought into the lab in order to look at the institution of psychiatry through this lens of institutional corruption. And it becomes a really, I think, good way to try to understand how you could have a medical profession, psychiatry, that in what you really, when you drill down into their behavior, the institution's behavior for the past 30, 40 years, you can really see this betrayal of the public. And what you see over and over again are two economies of influence. One, that pharmaceutical companies, you know, begin giving a lot of money to the American Psychiatric Association and to leading academic psychiatrists at medical schools to serve as their consultants, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And together, they told a story that really pushed, helped build a market for psychiatric drugs. The second influence, though, is psychiatry's own guild influence. In other words, as an association, as a medical profession, their product really became drugs starting in the 1980s. And so they wanted to tell a story that helped, frankly, promote the use of those drugs.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So basically that's the framework. Rather than sometimes we think, oh, are these people just, are they bad people, that sort of thing. And what the framework of institutional corruption allows you to see is how these influences get a whole group of people who may be well-meaning to start seeing things in a way that actually leads them to betray their mission. And, of course, the mission of a medical society, medical profession, is to serve the public and
mm-hmm.
to try to, with informed consent, develop the best treatments and also allow us to make informed decisions about using these medications.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the best examples of this, and you cover it in the book, is Prozac, the wonder drug, and how actually the placebos worked better than the actual drug, and yet it became one of the most popular antidepressant drugs in the world for many, many years. It may even still be, is it?
Well, Prozac, obviously was the first of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And as you say, it was pitched to the public as this unbelievable wonder drug that could make you feel better than well. And that class of drugs, the SSRIs, are certainly one of the biggest sellers of any type of drugs, and increasingly around the world. Now, there's many SSRIs, and there's some other sort of similar antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's that class of drugs that became so popular. In the United States, more than 10% of adults take an antidepressant every day. And if you go back to the Prozac trials, well, first of all, the German authorities didn't even want to license the drug because they said this drug is totally unsuitable for depression. And that was because if there was any benefit over a placebo, it was a small benefit. But they were also seeing a lot of really adverse effects. They were seeing some suicidal impulses emerge. Even some homicidal impulses emerge. So what you see when you look at the Prozac story is a new drug, a new compound that barely beat placebo, probably wasn't as effective as the old tricyclic drugs, had all sorts of adverse events. That was in the data that was sent to the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
But when we hear about it at the in the public, we just hear about a drug that is just a wonder drug,
right?
Practically cures depression, no adverse effects, and this does launch the use of drugs for depression in a big scale way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the societal injury, which is the second part of that subtitle. In 1987, we had 1.25 million adults on disability. This is just one marker of the burden of mental illness. Today, we have around 5 million adults on disability, and the largest percentage of this increase is due to mood disorders. It's due to depression and it actually correlates with the increased use of antidepressants.
Well, and then, you know, there's this, that after the FDA announced, and I'm reading this out of your book, in 2004, that most pediatric trials of SSRIs had failed, and that these drugs also doubled the risk of suicidal ideation in youth. And it seems that the pediatric market for SSRIs might collapse. But it goes on to say both the British Medical Journal and Lancet published articles concluding that prescribing these drugs to youth was a contradiction. And so, I read it wrong.
Yeah.
And so you read stuff like that and you're like, oh my God, how does this happen where even our children are not protected from this level of greed and corruption?
You know, it was amazing that Lancet and the British Medical Journal said this was an example of the betrayal of the trust that the public puts in medicine. Because there were two things that was happening with these pediatric trials. One is they weren't working. In other words, they weren't beating placebo. Two, you were seeing this increased risk of suicide. I'm talking about in the raw data. And then that was hid. That was hid from the published reports. They managed to, you know, through spin and, you know, cherry picking of data and that sort of thing, they turned failed studies into positive studies.
Mm-hmm.
They hid the suicidal risk. Now, I know a number of parents who, thinking that the data had shown that these drugs were effective and safe for their kids, had their kids put on Prozac, and I know these parents lost their kids to suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they find out that the data actually showed a doubling of the risk of suicide, you can imagine how they feel betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where literally what you see is professionals at academic medical schools, I'm talking about doctors, putting the interests of pharmaceutical companies and their faith in these drugs ahead of their duty to protect the children's health.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, I'm reading from your book again, and we're talking about the rising burden of mental illness. It's funny that you went there because that's where I wanted to go as well. Meanwhile, societal spending on psychiatric drugs rose from, like you said, around $800 million in 1987 to more than $30 billion in 2012. You have to ask yourself the question, what are we doing and how are we allowing this to happen? And, you know, people don't like to think about it, but it's true. You know, like Wall Street is involved here. Big media is involved here because those are the biggest advertisers of these drugs. If you watch anything on television or you pick up any magazine, you're going to, even a small publication like Eating Well, for example, I've got several copies of it, you know, in my stash here, where you'll go through a magazine like that and there'll be at least five advertisements for pharmaceutical drugs, and several of them are for antidepressants. And I feel like they're targeting women as well.
Well, they are targeting women. Yeah, this is part of the problem. You have to follow the flow of money. It goes to the medical journals. Often, by the way, sometimes the editors have even been serving as consultants to
mm-hmm.
pharmaceutical companies. But then you have the general media interest magazines. They're heavily funded by drug companies.
Oh, yeah.
So much of TV is funded by drug companies, their ads. And then, of course, if you look at lobbying dollars going to Congress, there's a flood of lobbying dollars from the pharmaceutical industry. So what you have in our society is this flow of wealth that helps tell one story. These drugs are great, and everyone, you know, we need to have more people treated for this, and keeps out, frankly, does keep out, you know, the scientific story. And the scientific story is telling of drugs that aren't very effective even over the short term. There's a lot of data showing that antidepressants over the long term actually increase the risk that someone will become chronically ill.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these suicidal risks and these mounting burdens of mental, you know, just, you know, from mental illness, mental disorders. And none of that really gets played out to the public. You mentioned in the very nice intro you gave that I run something called Mad in America, which is a website that tries to publicize the scientific information. And one final thing here. A few years back, I was asked to give a presentation to a work group in the UK's parliament. And the reason they invited me, they said, how come every country that is using antidepressants in a big scale way is seeing this rising burden of mental illness? So it's not
mm-hmm.
even, this social injury isn't limited to the United States.
Yeah. Well, are you going to stay with us a little bit longer?
I sure am.
Okay, good. Robert Whitaker is who you're listening to. He is an American journalist and author who has won numerous awards as a journalist covering medicine and science. You're listening to One Life Radio. We'll be right back with Robert Whitaker. Riding just as fast as they can.
One Life Radio is brought to you by our sponsors, great companies like Sun Warrior Plant-Based Protein. Use the code OLR for 20% off. Crazy Water, the only mineral water bottled in Texas. KetoMed, ketogenic metabolic nutrition. Use the code OLR for $40 off and free shipping. Honest Hemp, happy, healthy, honest CBD. Use the code OLR for 20% off. Nature's Plate, plant-based meals to go. Paleo Magazine, Wellbeing Journal, and the International Society of Sports Nutrition. Be sure to go to our Thorne Research Dispensary on our website for 20% off and free shipping. Thank you for listening to One Life Radio.
Welcome back to One Life Radio, everyone. This is Bernadette with Diamond Gray, Aviana Barrientos, Marie Early, Dr. Mike McFarland, and our special guest, Robert Whitaker. If you're just now joining us, he is an American journalist and author who has won numerous awards as a journalist covering medicine and science in 1998. He co-wrote a series on psychiatric research for the Boston Globe that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. His first book, Mad in America, was named by Discover Magazine as one of the best science books of 2002. Anatomy of an Epidemic won the 2010 Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for the best investigative journalism. He is the publisher of madinamerica.com, and such an honor to have him on the show with us. We're talking about psychiatry under the influence, which is one of his many books, Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. And so, you know, Robert, I'd like to ask you this. How skewed is our view and treatment of mental illness in America?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Basically, it's totally out of sync with the underlying science, or what you find in the scientific literature. So our belief is, and we've been, you know, told this, is that these are known brain illnesses. For a long time, we were told that these were chemical imbalances, that they were due to chemical imbalances in the brain, and the drugs fix those chemical imbalances. Well, just to show you how skewed that was, say, for example, we heard that depression was due to too little serotonin, and then you took an antidepressant, which ups serotonergic activity, and therefore balanced it out, like insulin for diabetes. Well, as early as 1983, the National Institute of Mental Health, investigating this hypothesis, said, we're just not finding that anybody, that a problem with the serotonergic system is a cause of depression. That was 1983.
Wow.
In 1998, the American Psychiatric Association's own textbook said that hypothesis didn't pan out. We haven't found that these things, that these mental disorders are due to chemical imbalance.
Right.
So you ask, how far are we skewed? Well, we were told that this was the problem. They could fix it. And their own research was showing that they weren't finding that to be so. Now, part of the skewing of this, though, is this. If you take an antidepressant, which does up serotonergic activity for a time, your brain, being this incredibly plastic organ, will actually dial down its own serotonergic activity. It'll reduce the density of its receptors for that molecule. So the irony of this whole story is this. The drugs actually perturb normal functioning. In response to that perturbation, your brain goes through this compensatory adaptations, and the drugs actually drive your brain. They induce the very abnormality hypothesized to cause the illness in the first place. So, for example, if you go on an antidepressant, you actually do end up physiologically with a serotonergic system that is operating at a lower level than normal.
Mm-hmm.
And researchers are even saying maybe this is the reason you'll see so much chronicity, is because they are sort of disabling or at least impairing the function of these neurotransmitter systems. So going back to your question, is how badly skewed is it? It's like going down the rabbit hole of Alice in Wonderland. Everything is almost the reverse of what we think is known and true.
Wow. That's very disturbing on so many different levels. I mean, there's so many people in this country. We already talked about the increase in mental illness in this country. It's so disturbing on so many levels, the greed, the corruption, all these people that are suffering unnecessarily because of the greed and just the proliferation of this lie about these drugs that really don't do anything but cause even more damage to the mind. correct?
It was certainly on a big level and a social level and an aggregate level. Yes, the drugs clearly, on the whole, increase the chronicity of disorders and increase the likelihood of impaired functioning. That's what you see over and over again. And if you go back to this idea, we don't know the biology of these problems, and then you take a drug that impairs normal functioning, you know, of a dopamine system or a serotonin system, you really wouldn't expect over the long term that would have a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the tragedies here is it's not that there aren't things we can do to help people out of a depression or help people out of anxiety or help kids who are struggling in school. There are all sorts of sort of environmental responses,
oh, yeah,
non-drug responses. I know you emphasize nutrition.
Oh, yeah.
Nutrition, obviously, if you believe in a mind-body connection, is very helpful. Getting sleep is helpful. Getting exercise is helpful. Helping people socialize is helpful. But rather than do all those things that common sense tells us we know actually can help people, you know, feel better emotionally and all, we say, oh, the answer's in a pill. That's part of the tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're being poisoned by our food. I watched another documentary this morning. What's With Wheat is the name of it. So disrupting to watch how all of this is happening with being poisoned, so many toxins, you know, leading back to, you know, the history of the, you know, the 21st century. So many people have been poisoned through their wheat and their corn and all these things that we ingest daily. They're in everything. They're disrupting, you know, our gut, which disrupts our mind. We now know the science of the connection between the gut microbiome and good mental health and just all these things, and they're all influenced by greed. They're all influenced by Wall Street and these publicly traded companies that the most important thing is the bottom line. But the children and this in our country are paying a huge price for this. You know, talking about the increase in suicide, I just had a friend over the weekend. Coincidentally, I hadn't seen him in about a year. His son, 22 years old, committed suicide. I'm just heartbroken over it. It's truly heartbroken to hear news like that. But this happens over and over again in this country. And so, you know, like I just said, we know that greed and corruption drive these pharmaceutical sales. But where do you draw the line when it comes to prescriptions and medications for those struggling with any type of mental or, you know, psychological disorder? Where do you draw the line?
Well, you know, I think you draw the line at informed consent. And by that, I mean, you know, there is some sign that sometimes the medications can help people over the short term get out of a difficult situation. People need to know the risk and, you know, potential benefits, that equation, in order to give informed consent. But I think, so it's whether you draw the line on an individual basis or a social basis, or sort of a society-wide basis. So an individual can hopefully make informed consent. They haven't been making informed consent because they've been told this story, this narrative that is out of sync with science. Societally, I think this is calling for us to fundamentally rethink how we help each other and help our society stay well. How do we nurture healthy children? How do we, you know, nurture healthy adult populations? Because clearly we're doing a lousy job at it. You mentioned food supply. I think that is a problem. There's so many problems. But you can organize your society in different ways that, like, you can do much better raising healthy children, mm-hmm, both physically and emotionally. I mean, if you go to colleges today, in some schools, more than 50% of the students will access mental health services during the 4 years. More than 25% arrive with a diagnosis and a prescription. So that's telling you, like, what is our society doing? But I think, going back to your question, where do we draw the line? Two different answers to that. In terms of individuals, we need to start having sort of an informed population about risk, benefits, what the really drugs do. And then at a societal level, we got to say, this paradigm of care has failed. This that makes big profits for drug companies, but for us as a people, it's failed. So how do we embrace and develop and nurture other approaches to emotional health and well-being?
Mm-hmm. The name of that documentary is What's With Wheat, and it's by Cindy O'Meara. So many people that have been regulars on the show are actually featured in it. Everyone should watch it. Definitely need to watch it. They could I'm going to put this out. I'll put it out on social media where they can watch it. ChangingHabits.com is the name of the website of the woman who produced it and directed it. But incredible film, incredible conversation here with you today, Robert Whittaker. Thank you so much for jumping on the air with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's my pleasure as well. Thank you so much. Everyone, I hope you enjoyed that. We've got more coming up with Dr. Mike McFarland, PhD. We're going to be talking about identifying and treating binge eating disorders. We'll be right back. One Life Radio is brought to you by our sponsors, great companies like Sun Warrior Plant-Based Protein. Use the code OLR for 20% off. Crazy Water, the only mineral water bottled in Texas. KetoMed, ketogenic metabolic nutrition. Use the code OLR for $40 off and free shipping. Honest Hemp, happy, healthy, honest CBD. Use the code OLR for 20% off. Nature's Plate, plant-based meals to go. Paleo Magazine, Wellbeing Journal, and the International Society of Sports Nutrition. Be sure to go to our Thorne Research Dispensary on our website for 20% off and free shipping. Thank you for listening to One Life Radio. Welcome back to One Life Radio, everyone. This is Bernadette. I want to let you know that you can go to our website, oneliferadio.com, to download and listen to our podcast or subscribe to our newsletter. You can also go to iHeartMedia.com to listen live or download the free iHeartRadio app and listen to us from anywhere in the world. And a big shout out to our sponsors, great companies that bring this content to you because they care about you like we do here at One Life Radio. Great companies like Sun Warrior. You can get it at Vitamin Shop or put it in your smoothie at Smoothie King or go to their website, sunwarrior.com, and use the code OLR for 20% off your order. All your orders. And of course, Crazy Water, call us crazy. We don't mind because we love Crazy Water. We love mineral water and it's local. So it's great. If you live here in Texas, you can even drive to Mineral Wells and you can buy it in the big containers and bring it home. And they have a little spa there and everything. So check it out, Crazy Water here in Mineral Wells, Texas. And of course, Honest Hemp, happy, healthy, honest. Visit them at honesthemp.com and use the code OLR for 20% off your order. And Paleo Magazine, great recipes, products, and articles on all around wellness and the Wellbeing Journal. The same thing, heralding the integration of medicine with physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and social aspects of health. And KetoMed, ketogenic metabolic nutrition. Find them at ketomed.com and use the code OLR for $40 off your first order or any of your orders, I guess just a order, and free shipping as well. So it's OLR for $40 off. And Nature's Plate, plant-based meals to go. I'm heading there after I leave the studio today to get my daughter's lunches for the week to save me a little time. And of course, Thorne Research. You can find our dispensary at oneliferadio.com/Thorne. Visit our dispensary at our, like I said, oneliferadio.com/Thorne to get 20% off anything you order as well as free shipping on your orders as well. So I love having Dr. McFarland in studio. He's one of my favorite guests. He's been on the show for a very long time. He is a licensed psychologist in the state of Texas with a private practice in Dallas. Dr. Mike provides individual therapy to adolescents through adulthood. He specializes in the treatment of anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive spectrum disorders, that's OCD, and male body image and eating disorders. You can find him at his website, McFarlandPsychology.com. That's McFarlandPsychology.com. Okay, identifying and treating binge eating disorders. So what exactly is a binge eating disorder?
Well, binge eating disorder is, I think, the newest of officially defined eating disorders, defined in 2013 in the
DSM.
The DSM-5. Exactly.
Okay, it's a 5 now. Yeah, it's up to 5.
We're up to 5.
They keep changing it. How
well,
interesting.
Well, you know, more and more and more. You know, we keep coming up with more and more mental disorders.
Got to update it.
And a lot of times, it's just older disorders that are better understood and redefined and reshaped over time.
That's good.
But binge eating disorder was considered in the category of eating disorder not otherwise specified. So pretty vague. Mm-hmm. And now it's got its own specific description and set of criteria for diagnosing. Essentially, binge eating disorder is recurrent episodes of binge eating. And we all know what binge eating is. Mm-hmm. We've got an idea in our heads, but specifically—
Or binge drinking?
We know what
Do
that
they go
is,
hand
too.
In hand?
Well, not necessarily,
no? Okay.
But that could be another issue. Binge drinking, impulse control kind of thing, but it could also indicate dependence on alcohol. Another topic for another time, but it'd be a good one. What we're talking about in terms of what an actual binge is, we all kind of think, oh, yeah, I binged, but it probably wasn't a binge. It maybe was a splurge. A binge is where, over a discrete period of time, you actually eat way more than is normal for a regular person. And you tend to feel very uncomfortable in that process. So let's say over a two-hour period, you might be eating until you're uncomfortably full. Maybe you feel out of control. You might feel like you're uncomfortably full, but you just keep going. Mm-hmm. You just keep shoveling the food
and
in.
And that's where you cross the line, kind of, which identifies it as an eating disorder, like
exactly.
a binge disorder.
Yes, exactly.
Because, I mean, I snack at night, and I think, you know, when you're talking right now, I'm like, oh, my God, did I snack too much last night? You know,
we all do that.
We all kind of do it a little bit, yeah.
Right. And the difference is that people who are binging are consuming, you know, they might consume 1,500, 2,000 calories within that two-hour period, which essentially would be the caloric intake for your entire day if you were being
healthy. That's easy to do with a big bag of chips or something or a gallon of ice cream. Some people will lose their mind on that type of thing. So eating a whole gallon, like a half gallon of ice cream would be like a binge.
Probably, yes, but then that doesn't mean you have binge eating disorder. So the question is, you know, do you meet the criteria? One of those criteria is that you're doing this at least once a week for a three-month period.
Mm-hmm.
So if, I mean, we, you know, we can probably think about, oh, yeah, that time in July when I got that gallon of, you name it, ice cream and ate it all. Well, that was one time.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about.
Have you done that? Avi's over there laughing.
I think I did that last week.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm guilty.
Guilty. But all in one sitting?
I split it up into 2 days, but you know.
Oh, well, that's okay. So that's
there's
a good
no
question.
Shame.
So
there's no shame.
So if you break it up into 2 days, that's just a tasty treat.
Sure.
A big one.
It was a bit excessive, but you know.
A little
but
obsessive.
If it's the 5 gallon party pail that they serve, they sell at Kroger, maybe not.
Yeah, right. Then you've got a problem. Well, so how do binge eating disorders differ from regular overeating?
It's mainly volume, it's frequency, it's how often you're doing it. It's whether or not you have the ability to detect when you're full. And so many people with binge eating disorder, they will describe feeling like they're a bottomless pit. You know, no matter how much they eat, they'll keep eating. Mm-hmm. I've had clients who could binge on, and this is going to be hard to imagine, but if nothing else is in the kitchen, binge on flour.
Oh, wow.
What?
They'll eat anything.
That makes
Crisco.
Me so sad.
Crisco.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's not about enjoying the food so much.
Right.
It's serving some other psychological purpose.
Does it release dopamine?
It does.
When you're doing that?
Yep. It's an impulse / compulse oriented behavior.
Wow.
So people tend to be very impulsive and just start eating, or they might feel compulsive like they cannot stop.
Yeah. Wow.
And so it's very difficult. 3.5% of women are estimated to have binge eating disorder at some point in their lives, and 2% of men. So it's pretty common, and we know people who have it. You might even be aware of someone in your family or friends who have it. Sometimes they mask it. So, for example, you might have a friend who will say, well, I'll go early to the restaurant and get a table. And then maybe they'll eat an appetizer and then have it taken away before their friends show up at the table.
Wow.
So they're kind of getting a second meal, things like that. There are a lot of tricks that people engage in to hide the behavior. But the bottom line is it gets in the way of your functioning a lot of times at work, certainly with relationships, and your sense of who you are as a person.
Is it indicative in their weight? Do they become obese?
Yes, yes.
Typically?
Someone who's overweight or obese. Not to be confused with the other half of bulimia. So bulimia, is associated with both binges and purges, whereas binge eating disorder, you just have the binging, and there won't be any compensatory behavior. Many times people develop a sort of a lifestyle that supports the binge. So let's say you binge in the evening, you consume 3,500, 4,000 calories on just stuff, and then you feel like crap you're very uncomfortable. Maybe you don't throw up, but you feel sick. You think, why did I do that? Tomorrow is going to be a different day. So they get up and they're like, I'm not going to do this today. I'm not going to do it. They start restricting and they may not eat, or they'll eat a couple crackers and they go on for a series of hours. And then by the time 6 o'clock at night rolls around, they're starving and set themselves up to binge again.
Oh, wow. Well, we're going to have to talk more about this. We went a little long on Robert Whitaker, but I love the information he was putting out today. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Mike. Always great to have you in studio. Everyone, you get one body, you get one mind, and you get one life. Get out there today and make the most of it.